The world is going through changes. Changes happening at a speed that we have never seen before. This is leading to disruption, chaos, panic, fear, hysteria, and a turbulent economy and marketplace. How do you protect your wealth in a turbulent world? How do you invest for cash flow and alternative assets to escape the rat race in times of uncertainty? How do you decentralize yourself, your family, your community, your business, and your investments to become sovereign and escape the matrix? If you are looking for strategies, tactics, and techniques to escape the rat race and matrix, you are in the right place. My name is MC Lobsher, and this is Cashflow Ninja. This is Cashflow Ninja. I'm MC Lobsher. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of Cashflow Ninja and spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me. Every single thing about Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. Cashflowninja.com. You can grab a copy of my book, The 21 Best Cashflow Niches. You can subscribe to my newsletter, The Best Cashflow Niches Newsletter, in which I share one brand new, well-researched cashflow niche every single month. And you can join my mastermind, Cashflow Nirvana, which was built for freedom seekers and wealth builders, business owners, and investors that's looking to protect and build wealth during turbulent times. I've got a fantastic show for you today. I'm joined by Neil Bawa. He is a multifamily syndicator and a data scientist, and he's going to share with us what his data is telling him is going on in multifamily real estate, and also share what his data is telling him is going on in other real estate niches. Neil, great to see you.
Yeah, likewise. It's good to be back on the podcast.
Absolutely. And for folks that did not listen to the first episode I did with Neil Bawa, you can go to cashflowninja.com. Just type in Neil Bawa. You'll find the episode that Neil did with us previously on the Cashflow Ninja. For folks that are not familiar with you and what you do, what are you up to these days? Who's Neil Bawa?
I'm a technologist, a data scientist that uses data to hack different things in life, from growing tomatoes in my backyard to growing my real estate portfolio, which currently is about $1 billion, has about 900 investors. I publish a large amount of data science. There's about 25,000 people that attend my data science webinars and 12,000 that are taking my Udemy real estate data science course. So I'm a geek. I'm a nerd. I believe in numbers, and I believe that data beats gut feel by a million miles.
All right. So let me take you in. Let's get into your mind here, right? Let's see what you're up to. Side note, by the way, I love the tomato growing in your backyard. I just had a fantastic arugula salad that we grew in our backyard as well. But take me into what you're seeing right now and what is the data telling you? What's your worldview of what's going on in the multifamily space? Maybe if you want to go bigger first, economically, banking and financial, monetary system, feel free to start wherever you want.
Sure. So most people don't realize this, but multifamily prices have been falling, and they've been falling for about 16 or 17 months. So on January 1st of 2022, which is, 18 months ago, multifamily prices were the highest in history on a per door basis or on a cap rate basis. So cap rates in the United States were as low as 3.36%. In case you don't understand that, basically that means extraordinarily expensive, right? So we were at 3.36. Today, four quarters later, we're at 4.72 cap, which is still extraordinarily expensive, but it's not as eye-popping as it was 18 months ago. So it's somewhere close to where it really should be, right? So fairly close to it where it should be. So those are the cap rates. Now, what does that really mean? That 136 basis point change from 3.36 to 4.72. And by the way, if you're seeing that number go up, well, as that number goes up, prices go down, right? So what you need to know is this. When real estate multifamily goes from 3.36 to 4.72, that 136 basis point difference or 1.36% difference means a 29% price reduction. So just remember that part. Forget the cap rates, right? So prices have dropped by 29%. Now, some people in the marketplace are like, no, they really haven't dropped that much. And they're sort of maybe right, because what happened is that 3.36, that peak, it was really there for just two quarters. So cap rates were not that low. They spiked in Q4 of 2021, and then they stayed there for Q1 of 2022. And since then, down, 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 you know, well, up, up, up in cap rates, down, down, down in prices. So some people are like, yeah, maybe they didn't really drop 29%. Well, from peak they did. Most people feel like they've dropped 20%. So maybe they didn't engage with that peak. And the challenge is simply this. According to Yardi Matrix, there are 2,500 properties in the United States, mostly purchased by syndicators, all of them purchased using floating rate or bridge loans. Bridge loans and floating are similar, but not exactly the same. The bottom line is those rates go up as interest rates go up, right? 2,500 properties have been purchased, almost all by syndicators, that are right now at one DSCR. Now, for people who understand this industry, they go, oh, crap. He's talking about 2,500 properties that are now beginning to bleed and will now aggressively accelerate their bleed, because most of this bleeding has really happened in the last 3, 4, 5 months as the Fed keeps raising and raising. And now with every raise, the bleed gets worse and worse and worse, right? So you're just taking the existing pain and you're stacking more pain on top of it. And even worse, more and more of these 2,500 properties are either coming to the end of their rate cap lock, or they're coming to the end of their loan, because bridge loans, floating rate loans, are usually 2 years or 3 years long. There are possibilities of extension, but according to Yardi Matrix, none of these 2,500 properties are eligible for refinance. Why? Because their DSCR is at one. Once again, if you don't know what that is, it simply means that the property is able to pay its mortgage. At one, it's able to pay its mortgage and nothing more. That's a point of great danger, because you can get hit with one big bill. Maybe your property taxes come in higher and you're screwed, right? So obviously lenders hate that. Lenders want you to be at 1.25 DSCR, which means that if your mortgage is $100, you're making 125. So you've got a little bit of pocket money that goes into your pocket or your investors' pockets. We're not seeing any properties in the US at or close to 1.25 DSCR that were purchased in the 2020 to 2022 timeframe using bridge loans. And so many of these properties are bleeding. Some that have come to me, because I'm running a rescue fund, are bleeding by $200,000 to $300,000 a month. And their lenders are saying, your property has no equity. The $16 million that your investors invested is gone. Refinance this property or hand the keys back to me. And I do not see any option for these properties. We are talking, MC, about $50 to $75 billion of multifamily properties that are insolvent, all from the last 3 years. That is the reality. And the multifamily industry is doing a magnificent job of ignoring it, just as much as the single family crisis was ignored in 2006 and 2007. No difference. I see people with the same, I'm an ostrich. My head is buried in the sand, or better still, it's up my ass.
Yep. No, and you know, you like myself, I want to look at what I'm dealing with. I want to understand my environment and come up with, you know, strategies to protect and grow and so forth. So this is where we are at right now. So if we're looking at a market cycle, right? So we had our peak. Well, what was that? January 2022, you were saying?
First quarter of 2022 was really the peak, the most absurd prices.
So that was your euphoria, your blow off top. And then there was a pullback. And then there was complacency, because, you know, all these people that are in trouble are not running around telling people they're in trouble. Everybody's right. just pretending that it's business as usual. The music is playing. There's enough chairs for everybody to sit in. And then once complacency kind of plays out, well, then you've got the blow off top. Then you have the full kind of pullback. And you're saying that this is up and coming because
I can tell you exactly when it's coming. I'm going to tell you exactly when it's coming. So a bunch of these properties, their loans start to renew at the end of this year. Okay, a bunch of them, not all of them, not 2,500, maybe 500 properties. So what happens is if your loan is renewing at the end of the year, you need to start figuring out what to do 3, 4, 5 months before that. Well, 3, 4, 5 months before that, 5 months before that is July 1st. I mean, pretty much now, right? July, August, right? So in August, people are going to realize my lender doesn't want me to refinance their property. And maybe I thought my lender would be nice to me and give me an extension, but here's the news. Banks failed. Silicon Valley Bank failed. First Republic Bank failed. So guess what the Federal Reserve did? They held a phone call, called in hundreds and hundreds of banks into a phone call and said, guys, we need to make sure that you are not going to be the next First Republic. So we're going to ask you to do what is known as mark to market. It's a very technical term. What it really means is you need to go look at your assets and tell us what they're worth today. And you need to write down the book value of those assets in your book. And yes, that means you're going to lend a lot less money, but so be it. Go do it. The Fed said that to these banks, which means that the bank simply can't kick the can down the road. If the asset was purchased for $30 million with a $20 million loan, and now the asset today is worth $20 million, the bank has to write its value down. Now, once the bank writes its value down to $20 million, they cannot legally extend that loan because they're supposed to be 70% LTV. If you're at 100% LTV, the only option the bank has is to tell that syndicator, tell that owner, you need to bring in another $6 or $7 million if you want me to extend your loan because you're at 100% LTV, right? You've got a $20 million loan with a $20 million property. Remember, and how did I get there? Well, remember I told you a 29% decline? So in the worst case scenario, properties have declined by 29% from 30 million. Now you're down to 21 million and your loan's 20 or 21 million, right? So the lender's not going to let you be because they're being forced to mark to market by the Federal Reserve. What really changed was Silicon Valley Bank forcing all of these mid-tier banks to basically mark down their assets. Until then, they were part of the joint delusion that somehow we're going to get through this by extending these properties. Because if these properties, if every one of these 25 properties can somehow make it to Q4 of 2024, Q4 of next year, they're safe. They're safe. This isn't 2008. This isn't a meltdown of that size. The total amount of equity at risk is $30 to $40 billion. By the way, 2008 was $7 trillion. $7 trillion dollars were lost in that time frame. So I'm talking about $30 billion. So keep the perspective, right? But inside of the industry, if you have a property that's in trouble, you don't think $7 trillion versus $30 billion. You think, oh, shit, right? So to you, it's a career-ending, you know, event. And so it's extremely stressful. But if you're not a multifamily investor and you're thinking, is this going to bring the U.S. economy down? Hell no. Hell no. It's only $30 billion. Compare that to $7 trillion 2008. So it's a potential existential crisis for the syndication industry. It may even be a crisis for the entire multifamily industry because there's a lot of multifamily that has nothing to do with syndication. It may even possibly, in the worst case scenario, be a crisis for the entire real estate industry. Is it a crisis for the United States? Nah, $30 billion is nothing.
I want to take a moment to share something very important right now. Are you trying to figure out how to protect your savings from the banking collapse, which has already started, and the coming financial crisis? Most banks will fail. Deposits that are not insured by the FDIC will be lost, and there will be bank bail-ins. And this collapse in the banking system will lead to chaos in the financial system. Banks also provide loans to real estate investors. So what do you think is going to happen to lending in the event of a banking and a financial crisis? You can be proactive and position your savings to protect it and also have access to it to use it to buy discounted assets by positioning it in your own banking system through the infinite banking concept strategy. Producers Wealth has put together a presentation at yourownbankingsystem.com where you will learn how to position capital outside of the banking system and the Wall Street casino, just like the ultra wealthy, to protect it and create a pool of tax-free liquid capital to capitalize on the massive opportunity to buy discounted assets, which is coming. You can access the presentation at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. And I also just want to like zoom out quickly, like from a macro standpoint. Now you look at, let's just look at the global economy, right? Central banks around the world have raised rates, and they've continued to raise rates. They're trying to combat inflation, especially, you know, with the COVID spending. And now, you know, the Republicans and Democrats just basically with this extension of the debt ceiling, which should be known as the debt target because they hit it every single time. But extending that is giving you COVID level spending without COVID. So that just happened like on a macro basis. So from an inflation standpoint, we're raising rates to combat it, but yet we've continued to let it loose. We're going to keep letting it loose. So, you know, what that tells me is, I don't know if you like, where does it break? Because you're going to have to keep raising to combat inflation. And there's now just more currency that's going to be created, right? Kind of like catch 22 situation. Then you brought up the banking crisis. Huge. This impacts everything. Because the banks are, those are your lenders. And if you look at the banks that are being targeted in this takedown, kind of like my view of it is like the small and regional banks are being eaten by the too big to fails. So eventually.
And that's going to continue. I expect many more banks to fail, MC. And you're like, why did only three banks fail? Well, the answer is simple. It takes time because the banks are reporting their results once a quarter, right? So Silicon Valley Bank failed very late in Q1, very late. So the banks were not affected. Their Q1 profits were not affected because the event happened so late, right? Now, what about Q2 profits? Oh yeah, they're massively affected, especially if you're a mid-sized bank. You just lost billions or tens of billions of dollars of money fleeing to the too big to fail banks. So your profits right now are getting slaughtered, but no one knows. Because the banks won't report that until sometime in Q3. They will report their first post-Silicon Valley Bank quarter in August. Well, all hell is going to break loose when 300-400 banks report that they've shrunk by 30%.
Right. And I share the same view. Just if you look at the Bank for International Settlements, their CBDC model is basically they were telling you, look, for that model to work, you got to take out all the small and regional banks, only have a handful of Fed member banks and the too big to fail banks left. Now, who are the lenders in real estate? They're small and your regional banks, right? And a ton of those banks are already sitting with commercial property, which, you know, I'm sure nobody saw this coming. All those office buildings that sat empty in New York City and San Francisco.
That's right.
And so forth.
That's right.
So you're dealing with that part too, which isn't part of multifamily.
It isn't, but it's part of the overall problem, right? So So I gave you the number for multifamily. We're looking at maybe $30, $35 billion at risk, which again, not the largest number when it comes to the macro economy. But if you put in office, hotel, retail, and all of the other asset classes, then you're over $100 billion. And so the banks, the mid-sized banks, are not at risk for 30. They're really at risk for that $100 billion. 36% of America's office is loaned by mid-sized banks. 36% of office, 45% of retail. Only 19% of multifamily is mid-sized banks. Why? Because multifamily has two organizations called Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which are government organizations, and their job is to give loans to multifamily. They don't give loans to offices, or they don't give loans to retail. So with multifamily, that's actually the smallest exposure that those banks have, but it's 19% of a bigger number, right?
Right.
So they can be 45% of a smaller number. It's still the dollars are going to be less than 19% of a bigger number. So overall, in dollar exposure, they're over $100 billion, and small to mid-sized banks fail much easier than larger banks. Larger banks can absorb $2, $5, $10 billion in losses pretty quickly. It's no big deal. But small to mid-sized banks, that's an existential event for them. And I strongly believe that as the crisis worsens and more office properties come up, office, I think, is going to lead the doom. Because with multifamily, we have options. There's rescue funds like mine that are basically going in there and saying, okay, I'll give you $4 or $5 million. Your existing investors lose most of their profit or any of their profit, but I'll refinance you to a fixed loan. The moment I refinance it, the crisis is over for that property, right? It's no longer bleeding. It may actually be making a penny or two. And it doesn't have to make a penny. As long as it breaks even, its crisis is over. Then you just wait for 2 years for rent to go up, for the property to start cash flowing. And then 2 years later, you refinance it at some slightly better rate, right? So there are options for multifamily. But MC, because, and by the way, that's because fundamental demand for multifamily is so strong. We are down from 96% occupancy to 95% occupancy. So all we've seen is a decline by 1%. And now it's clearly plateaued and might even be going on its way back up. Our rents have flattened, but they haven't gone down. We have, the U.S. hasn't lost a dollar in rent in the last 12 months of all this high inflation really affecting families and people starting to run out of COVID money. We haven't lost any money at all. All that's happened is our rent growth, which was astonishingly high, 16% a year, is now down to 1%, right? In some markets, minus one.
Yeah.
But in the end, overall, we're okay. Now imagine offices, right? Break-even point for most offices is around 90%. Well, the United States is currently sitting at 81%, and many markets are sitting at 70%. We already have $454 million of losses from a single 1 million square foot office that was in Los Angeles. We have $757 million from another set of offices and $1.7 billion in default from a set of offices that extend all the way from New York to San Francisco. This has all just happened in the last 5 weeks, right? Yep. So the dominoes are falling, but it takes time. Everything takes time. That, you know, real estate is slow to move. This doesn't mean that bad things aren't happening. It just means that it's not in the public eye.
Yeah. And, you know, if we look at, if we look at this play out, right, we've had a heck of a run since 2012, you know, till like 2022, like as you were saying, January of 2022. So if there's newer and younger investors listening to this, this is part of a market cycle and cycles repeat itself. You know, somebody asked me the other day, so you're like a cycle guy. I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, you believe in all these cycles. I'm like, the sun goes down at night and it comes up in the morning. You know,
there's nothing to believe. Cycles are obvious, right? So right. There is no data to support that any asset class from Bitcoin to real estate to technology has not been cyclical in nature, right? There are no known asset classes that are non-cyclical. So belief, this isn't about belief. This is about tangible data that has been replicated millions of times across hundreds of countries, thousands of cities, and thousands of asset classes. Cyclicality is the nature of business.
Right. It's and the other example that I used was, it's going to get really, really hot right now, by the way. And then in a couple of months, it's going to get a little bit cooler. And then it's going to start to rain. And then it's going to be snowfall in the northeastern part of the country.
And everyone accepts that. But they won't accept the cyclicality in, you know, hot things like multifamily. I'm telling you, this is the best thing that could happen for multifamily. Because there are only two ways in which cycles end. They either cool or they blow the fuck up. And that second one destroys it. You get 5 years of basically the horrible sort of stuff that we had to go through in 2008. So far, this is deflating. And I know that the people, investors that are going to lose their money are not going to feel that. But if I can be heartless and just purely logical in pure Spock mode, and I look at it from a 300,000 foot view, it's the best thing that could happen. You have a $1 trillion asset class that's about to lose $30 billion. That's 3% in value. That's the best way to deflate bubbles. People made $300 billion in the last 3 years. Out of that, $30 billion will be lost. Well, that, right. You're still $270 billion ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. This is kind of the slow kind of the air coming out of the bubble instead of a complete pop and a complete disaster because the loss
so far, but we're hoping that it obviously doesn't get to that level. What I'm concerned about is that the slow bubble that is coming out on the multifamily side, so far it's been good. Like, for example, let me tell you why it's a slow bubble. Like, if anyone's saying multifamily is popping, they're not paying attention. Today, every decent property still has 15 to 20 offers. None of the offers are in the 5.1, 5.2 cap range. They're all at 5 cap or 4.8 cap, 4.6 cap. So these are still very low cap rates compared to 2019. What happened in 2021, 2022 was a COVID-related insanity event that hopefully is never repeated, right? You know, obviously COVID was a one-off event in the history of the world. So But if you look at 2019, right, we're right there. We're right there. That's the level of interest. There's a massive amount of money. People want to deploy it. They're not willing to overpay anymore. They're not going to basically pay $30 million for a property that's worth $21. But that process of sellers and buyers adjusting their expectation is happening. Prices are going down, but it's happening. And there's no evidence that people are saying, I don't want to buy multifamily. People are simply, I'll sit on the sidelines until the price comes down a little bit. That's good, because that's how bubbles, you know, deflate. When people start saying, I don't want to buy multifamily, that's when bubbles burst. I'm seeing zero evidence of that. Almost every offer that I've made in the last 3 months, I've not even come close to winning a property, right? So there's still a lot of people willing to pay. So it's deflating. What I'm afraid of is there is no mathematical way that I know of to deflate the office bubble. That can only burst, and I'm afraid that it's going to cascade onto multifamily.
And with a slowing economy too, I'm starting to see stuff pop up in my news feed. You know, obviously hospitality has taken, you know, just a clubbing basically. But it looks like there's a ton of hotels still in that position. I mean, there's stories coming up from prime properties of people.
Yeah, I can't agree. I can't agree on that, MC. So here's what I'm going to say with hotels. Okay.
Yeah.
A ton of them are non-refinanceable. But hotels are doing extremely well from a revenue and profit perspective. If you simply Google hotel rates up in the United States, you'll notice that in the last 6 months, which is the first 6 months of this year, hotel average daily rent, or also called ADR, right, or average daily revenue, is up by shocking numbers. Their occupancy is up. So when your occupancy is up and your rents are up, you have options. Does that mean that you can refinance? No. But does it mean that your lenders can let you kick the can down the road? I think it's yes. So does that mean that dozens or hundreds of hotels won't go back to the bank? Yeah, no, but we're not looking at thousands of them going back to the bank. We're not looking at a debacle in the hotel sector. We were looking at that until about 7 or 8 months ago, but then their average daily rents and their occupancy started to rise so sharply that I think they're in the safer kind of zone today compared to where they were 6 months ago. And there are individual hotels that this doesn't apply from. Once again, 300,000 foot view, dozens of properties will go back to the bank from the hotel side, maybe hundreds. But the thousands that I'm worried about, I don't think will happen, because they've had a phenomenal 6 months of revenue growth.
Yeah. And there's very specific properties too. That's a very broad hospitality to throw everything in the same thing.
They're all very different, right? Yeah, so if you're a hotel in San Francisco, if you're a hotel in New York, you are in distress. You're in deep, deep distress, because what's happening is 30% of the people that used to come into the office are not coming into the office anymore. And you were serving a lot of that audience. People are not traveling as much. They're using Zoom. Overall business travel is down. Travel is up, huge. Right. But business travel is down. So if you're an Airbnb type of hotel, if you're in a beautiful location like Hawaii, you're killing it, man. But if you're in a business place like downtown New York, if you're in downtown San Francisco, you're in very serious distress.
That's actually the news story that I was referring to when I looked at my feed. Was a property downtown San Francisco, a prime property, where they just basically handed the keys back to the lender and saying,
that's going to happen a lot, right? Because there's this whole concept. People are saying stuff that makes no sense to me. So the first thing is, all the offices will get converted to something. All right. So here's a study from Yardi Matrix. This is very important. Sorry, I'm geeky. I like giving examples that are based on numbers, and they stick in my head. I can't forget numbers. You know, I'll wake up to pee in the morning at 2 o'clock and start thinking about a number that I, you know, heard about yesterday. But this is a very sexy one. They looked at 1,000 properties in New York. New York is, you know, along with San Francisco, New York's the worst affected for office. And they said, how many of these could we profitably convert to something else? Most likely condos, right? It's New York, after all. I mean, there's a big condo market. The answer is 36. Out of 1,000 plus properties, 36 convert. And you might say, why? Well, firstly, you keep in mind that somebody has to give you a $20 million, $50 million loan to do this conversion. So that bank has to believe that whatever you're converting into has higher value than what you're converting from. right? And so if the price you paid for the existing property is extremely high and you're going to put another $50 million on top of it, then the final product has to be really, really expensive. And condos are coming down in value in New York and San Francisco, once again, for the same reason that, you know, there's less people coming to the city, there are less people living in the city. So the condo market is not doing so well. It's not crashing or anything. It's not doing so well. So most banks actually do not see the ability for you to do a successful conversion. Here's the second thing. Most offices, the floor plate is too big. That's a technical way of saying not enough windows. If you have a thin building, it has a lot of windows and you can have condos everywhere. You can't build condos with no windows, right? Most states, it's illegal to have a room without a window, yeah. Right? That's a requirement to be called a room, right? You can't have a room with four walls and say, I have a four-bedroom house. It has to have a window. Well, the problem is if your floor plate is not like this, but it's like that, well, then you can only build condos around the periphery. All the area in the middle is wasted. And you can't afford to waste it because you paid so much for it. So 3% of the buildings in New York can be converted. What happens to the remaining 97%? Well, a bunch of them are occupied. And we don't have an office issue right now. I can tell you this. We have a Class B office issue. Class A occupancy in the United States is just fine. May fall in the future as more of these, you know, work from home things happen. But for the moment, Class A office is fine. Class B office is in, I don't think the right word is distress. I mean, it's like, holy shit, you have zero options. Absolutely nothing works.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors, Penumbra Solutions. Life Settlements Investments have allowed financial and banking institutions to not only buy their equity contractually, but also diversify their capital from any economic, market, and geopolitical risk. It's been part of the billion-dollar blueprint followed by institutional investors. If you're an accredited investor, you can also now participate in this vehicle with enormous growth potential. You can watch an informational webinar presented by one of the premier organizations providing life settlement investments, Penumbra Solutions, at cashflowninja.com/life settlements. That's cashflowninja.com/life settlements. The password to access that webinar is Penumbra, all lowercase. What are you seeing with your data points on, again, big 30,000 foot view just on single family? We've covered a couple of different, a couple of niches. What are you seeing in the single family?
I am completely surprised, and all of my predictions have been wrong and hugely wrong. So I predicted that as interest rates went from, you know, 3.5 to today, they're about 6.7, 6.8%. That's huge. That is, we're talking about $1,000 a month different in mortgage, right? It's disgusting, right? It's like, who the hell got $1,000 a month raise all of a sudden in the last 18 months just because the Federal Reserve raised interest rates? So I predicted home prices will be down 15%. I mean, not 2008, but down 15%. Completely wrong. They're only down 5%. And now in over 90% of the markets in the US, home prices in both March and April climbed. They were climbing again. There, you know, because it wasn't clear whether a lot of the drop that we had in the last 6 months was seasonal. As you know, home prices drop every year as we get into, you know, December, in January, they tend to drop and then they come back up. That's normal. And so it wasn't clear how much of that drop was interest rates, how much of that was seasonality. Well, it turns out a good portion of it was actually seasonality because March and April, which are traditionally good months, it's been upward. Even in San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay Area, which has been the worst hit market in the US, was up in March, was up in April. And the reason was simply this. The reason I was wrong was this. More than 95% of all single family real estate in the United States is locked in at loans under 4%. People are simply not selling. They're saying, if I have to do it, I'll rent my property. I think that interest rates eventually will go down. They're right. They will go down 18 months, two years, whatever it is. And then I'll have options. I'll sell it then. So there's no inventory in the marketplace. Multifamily doesn't have that choice. When you've taken floating rate loans and you're losing $100,000, $200,000 in the month, if you have the option to sell your property, you're going to sell it, right? You're not going to keep taking a $200,000 hit.
Yeah.
Single family owners don't feel that way. They'll rent it out. They'll even keep paying it because as a percentage of their income, just paying that additional 5, 6, 7, you know, well, it's not even that because 90% of them are locked in. So to them, nothing has changed in the last 18 months. All that has happened is their ability to sell their property has vanished and they're accepting it and they're moving forward. No market in the United States has fallen more than 10%. Phoenix is down 10. Austin's down like 9.6. You know, San Jose, San Francisco down. San Francisco's down a little more than 10% simply because it's hit for everything, right? San Francisco is just facing the perfect storm. So it's down more than 10%, but still not a debacle. There's still 20% of all properties being sold in San Francisco today are getting offers over, you know, what, over, you know, whatever they were asking for, right? Over asking. So the market's not melting down. I expected it would somewhat start to melt down. I didn't think it would be like 2008, but being completely wrong. So I thought we'd be at 15. We're at 5 and going upwards.
That's interesting. And could it be the other thing is, how does inventory look? Is inventory kind of...
We're down 50 to 75% in terms of overall inventory, down 50%. Some markets down 75%. The expensive markets like San Francisco are down, you know, 60, 70% in inventory. The cheaper markets like Cleveland down maybe 30% in inventory. But across the board, there is no panic. You know, there's large numbers of open houses. There's overbidding. What we've seen go out of the market are cash offers because the investor component seems to have left the single family market for now. They haven't left it. They're just sort of sitting on the sidelines. So what we are seeing is interest from buyers has come back because they've mentally adjusted. I mean, keep in mind, people bought single family homes in the 1980s at 18%. So buying a single family home is largely an emotional decision if you plan to live in it, right? Yeah. And women, predominantly women, make that decision. So for them, it is a homestead. So people have adjusted from 3.5% to 6.5% if they can make things work. We are seeing some distress in the higher end single family market. So homes over $1 million where people can't qualify are taking bigger hits, as much as 20%. But, you know, so basically whatever the price is in a metro, the top 10% of that is seeing significant reductions, 10, 20%. The rest of it is pretty stable. And I am surprised, but it basically turns out that COVID locked in all of their interest rates. What multifamily got wrong is that, you know, we as syndicators, as thousands of syndicators, didn't lock in our rates.
Yeah. One more question on the single family. And you mentioned the investor side of it. How does the Airbnb kind of like trend play into that? Because it seems like there was on the upper side of Airbnb, there's still a lot of people doing well. But the majority of the market looks a little bit more bare as far as performance. Are you seeing that? What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's shaky. It's the Airbnb market right now is shaky. You know, premium product is continuing to do well. You know, it's in demand. Rates have actually gone up for premium product. You know, occupancy may not have gone up. Maybe it's stable. So people are traveling. A lot of people are traveling. And so Airbnb is doing well from that perspective. But the market was over flooded. The prices were extremely high. So we're seeing a retrenchment. What I'll say is Airbnb is not a debacle. The market is not melting down. There's a lot less investors in there compared to 12 months ago. It may still melt down. It's shaky. There's this feeling of nervousness in the Airbnb market where they're saying, you know, if this is as bad as it's going to get, we're okay. But we think that it's going to get worse. And I think it is going to get worse. How much worse? Who knows?
Yeah. If you look at the retail, the retail consumer, and you look at trends in the United States, whether it be debt, household debt, and so forth. Yeah. I mean, the majority of the folks in the middle probably tapped out. You know, when it comes to savings rate, debt that they've taken on, folks that would have rented those Airbnbs in the middle, the premium products, I mean, it's still a different world.
People who have money are going to spend it. And, you know, they're going to, you know, feel a little less rich because they lost $1 million in the stock market out of their 100 million. But then after a month, they're like, okay, well, I'm still going to move on with my life. So the when it comes to Airbnb, the premium product is what is doing well. The $500 a night plus area continues to do well. Keep in mind, rich people were still locked up in their home for a year. And so there's revenge travel going on both from the rich and from the middle class. And the rich have more money to spend on revenge travel.
Look at the private jet aviation industry.
Oh no, it's exploded. I mean, it's coming down now. There's just a little bit of, you know, calmness there now, and the private jet industry is on its way down. But boy, they had an incredible 18 months. They were just selling every plane in America, right? And travel prices, just so you know, international travel prices are up 25 to 45% from last year, right? Yep. Who cares about 6% inflation when you're paying 45% more for an economy ticket to China or to Japan?
I see that. I've got family overseas and we looked at tickets and I mean, it's just shocking. And then in the high travel seasons, it's almost, it's laughable what they were charging, during those times. Yeah. This is interesting stuff. So, for investors listening to this, for folks that have invested into syndications, what are some things that you can share for them to think about, some things that they should be thinking, like, some things that they should be thinking about and some things that they should be doing?
Okay. All right. So there's two kinds of investors, people who invested in the last 2 years and people who didn't. If you didn't invest in the last 2 years, truly awesome for you. Imagine this. I'm selling you a Taco Bell. And that Taco Bell has $1 million in net operating income. And I come back to you 18 months later and say, my Taco Bell still has $1 million in income, but I'd like to take 29% less for it. Would you be willing to do that? Absolutely. Today, multifamily is highly discounted. Some markets are as little as 15%. Some are as high as 29%, you know, Phoenix being on the high end of that. It's a great time to invest into multifamily. But most people won't do it. Why? Because you're hearing bad stories. The Wall Street Journal recently said that one guy lost $200 million worth of property, Jay Cacciavelli. So you're not going to invest. But isn't this the same thing that you did in 2008 and 2009? You basically said, I'm not going to invest because the world is ending. Today, you don't care about whether you bought property in 2008 or 9 or 10 or 11. None of those were the trough years. Real estate in the United States bottomed out in 2012, 4 years after the crisis started. But find me one unhappy investor in the US that bought too early in 2008 or 9 or 10 or 11. You all made a shit ton of money because you bought stuff when it was cheap, right? Today, multifamily is cheap. So going forward, and I, by the way, expect it to get cheaper. I expect that it's going to go to 33% or 34%. But you just heard me in this segment say, I was wrong on how much I thought single family would drop by. I thought 15, we dropped 5. Point is, there's this wonderful concept called dollar cost averaging that people use in the stock market. And what they say is, after things have dropped a certain point and gotten cheap, I don't worry about it being cheapest because I'll never time the market right. So there's forces moving multifamily upwards and forces moving it downwards. All I know is it's 29% down. No one can dispute that because, hey, if you dispute that, Don't look at the CBRE report because that might actually prove something to you that you don't want to agree on. So bottom line, this is actually a great time to invest in multifamily. If you are willing to buy properties at $10 million more for the same income 18 months ago, why wouldn't you be willing to buy it in the second half of this year, especially as more distress develops and the prices drop further? The next 12 months, from an investor perspective, are an incredible time to buy. Now, what about the investors that invested in the last 24 months? I feel bad for you. My industry, the syndication industry, overdid it, bought too many properties, bought too many of them at, you know, too high prices. I'm part of the at fault because I trained a bunch of young guys and then I warned them. I only, by the way, it's just for disclosure, I only bought 2 properties in the last 2 years. All of my students bought 10, 12. I had a student of mine that bought 16 properties in 2 years. Now, without naming him, I'll say half of those properties are now upside down. Half of those properties are now bleeding. Now, out of my 2, 1 is bleeding. So, you know, mea culpa. I mean, nobody thought that the Fed would raise to 5.25%. I thought they'd go up to about 3.25% and they'd get inflation in control. Turned out to be wrong. So I have a property that's bleeding. I haven't done a cash call. I'm just feeding it my personal money. Point is, I bought 2. I was restrained. As an investor, it's very painful for you when you say, okay, what happened to me in the last 18 months was so painful that right now I will miss the opportunity out. I know prices are down, but I won't do it because, hey, 18 months ago, I didn't do well. Well, that's because you bought at a high price. Today, the price is low. The difference between a speculator and an investor is an investor looks at mathematics, and the math of multifamily today is pretty darn good. right?
Yep.
A speculator says, I didn't do well on X, therefore I will apply this to Y. Well, X and Y are not the same thing. And so as an investor, this is actually an opportunity. This is a time to invest. I would even invest in distressed funds for hotels. I, by the way, wouldn't touch office because that demand is gone for the next 10 years. So I wouldn't touch a distressed fund for offices at all. But a distressed fund for hotels, because their revenue is rising, their occupancy is rising, they're going to be, in my mind, the best market in the United States to invest in right now is actually hotels, as long as you invest with a distressed fund, right? Because these people are going to be picking off those hotels that should, their rent should be rising, but maybe their management sucks, or maybe they need a little bit of rehab. Well, then buy them cheap, right? Buy them for cash flow. What's the worst that can happen? You end up getting cash flow, big freaking deal. So I think distress creates opportunity. All, every investor I know knows Warren Buffett's words, right? Be greedy when others are fearful, be fearful when others are greedy. But the fact is, 9 out of 10 of you listening to me are still going to be greedy when others are greedy and still going to be fearful when others are fearful, because that is our nature to do that. We're not investors, we are speculators. So my suggestion to you is, this one time, be an investor.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors. My friend Dave Zook says, you can be conventional or you can be wealthy. Pick one. At The Real Asset Investor, Dave and his team bring their investors high-yield investment opportunities across several asset classes for cash flow, tax impact, and equity growth. He and his team are one of the top 5 ATM operators in the country, and they have an investment opportunity available to accredited investors right now in the ATM space. To learn more about their ATM funds that produce tax-free cash flow, visit therealassetinvestor.com. That's therealassetinvestor.com. And this is, again, it's different. It's a market cycle. There's different phases to this, you know, and there's different things that you need to do at different parts of the cycle. And like you were saying, if you look at what the professional investors are doing, they usually do the opposite of what everybody else is doing. When everybody else is running for the exits, they're coming in. You know, I interviewed Jim Rogers once, and I asked him about when the opportune opportunity for him is. And he said, it's when the money's lying on the floor there in the corner, and all I have to go do is pick it up. That's usually the opportune time for him. Where can folks learn more about you, what you're up to, where can they follow you, and where can they stay informed of all of the many projects that you're involved with?
Easiest way, simply Google my first and last name. I'm the only Neil Bao on the World Wide Web. So everything good is me. Everything bad is also me. If you want to formally follow us, multifamily followed by the letter U.com, Multifamily University, which is called MultifamilyU.com. We have about 25,000 registrations for our webinars. We do 8 of them a year, and 2,500 people register for each of them. They're data-driven, they're fun, and we do all kinds of topics. I do single-family, multifamily, commercial real estate. I just did one called The Upcoming Distress in Commercial Real Estate and Multifamily, and I had 2,000 people that registered for that one. And you know what the next webinar I'm doing is? How artificial intelligence is going to change the world. Really doesn't have much to do with real estate. I'll probably have a slide on real estate, but I'm just doing that as a, you know, as a, okay, fine, I have this little insight about real estate, but it's really about artificial intelligence. So we're data scientists. We see the world changing and we look at data and we try to keep up with trends. Some we invest in, some we don't. We don't invest in artificial intelligence, but it's a lot of fun to me. I love having fun and doing interesting things. The next one that I'm writing after AI is called New Energy and EVs. You know, these electric vehicles, and how 80% of all car manufacturers in the world will be dead by 2030. Gone, finished, right? Those are concepts. Now, so I take data and I apply them to different things. Real estate is one of those. I did one last year that was a big blockbuster hit called The Impact of Climate Change on Real Estate. It wasn't a Republican versus Democrat thing, because I simply just refuse to take sides. I'm just simply saying, here's what's happening to insurance costs. Here's what's happening to water costs. Here's what's happening to real things. Who cares what's causing climate change? I'm just telling you about the profitability impact of what's happening. Insurance costs are triple what they were 2 years ago in certain parts of the US. Things like that, right? It's a lot of fun. All of that at multifamilyu.com. You can also take my Udemy course by just typing in Udemy space Neil Bauer.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show again and sharing your insights and your knowledge. And of course, all of the data, giving us an update of all of the different niches and real estate.
You're welcome. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you to all of my listeners and my viewers for spending most valuable resource, your time once again with me on the show. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. Until next time, live infinitely. This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation, and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.